Welcome to Out in the Bay. I'm Eric Jansen. We are so overdue to talk politics with Matthew Bajeko. He's assistant editor and political columnist with the Bay Area Reporter, LGBTQ newspaper and online news outlet here in the Bay Area. Matthew tells me a new Chick-fil-A is opening just barely outside San Francisco's city limits. This is the chain boycotted by many LGBTQ folks for the CEOs and the company's past donations to anti-queer charities and political organizations. There's also quite a heated race for the California Assembly seat now open after David Chu left it to become San Francisco's city attorney November 1st. It's a seat that before Chu had been held for many years by a succession of LGBTQ assembly members. That's the lower house of the California legislature. We'll also get into details of some new laws that go into effect January 1st, new laws that will especially affect queer Californians. Matthew Bajeko, welcome back to Out in the Bay. It's good to see you again. It's been way too long.
Yeah, thanks for having me back, Eric.
Seems like there's lots of political stuff going on right now. Where would you like to start this week?
Well, one of the biggest news stories, I think, in the LGBTQ community here in the Bay Area is the opening November 18th of the latest Chick-fil-A location, conveniently located a two-minute drive outside of San Francisco at the Serramonte Center Mall. And for anyone who has followed the controversy with this fast food chain, it has a long history of donating to anti-LGBTQ groups and causes. 2 years ago, they had announced that they were going to pull back on some of that funding to two specific groups. But then just this summer, they were in the news again because one of their founders, who's, you know, benefits financially from the company, was found to be donating to efforts to block federal LGBTQ legislation.
That's the current CEO, Dan Cathy, is that his name?
Right. So for months now, I actually have had to drive down 280. I use that route often and had noticed construction of this, you know, brand new white building. And then a couple weeks ago, we were driving down 280 and they had installed the brand new neon signage for this location. And I was just stunned because of how close it is to San Francisco, where not only are chain stores, you know, long been looked at negatively in our city, but our city certainly has been one of the places where a lot of people in the LGBTQ community have voiced concerns about this particular restaurant.
It's in Daly City though, right? So there's a totally separate jurisdiction. They could do what they want.
Right.
But have there been, and I know that previously there have been protests like when, San Jose once a few years back. Has there been specific protests about this one opening?
I think it's just raising eyebrows. I've talked with people at the San Mateo Pride Center, which is their county's LGBTQ community center. And they told me last week that they weren't fielding calls yet. But one of their employees happens to live in San Francisco. So she told me she had the same reaction I did when she was driving down 280 one day, headed into the office and saw the signage. And just thought, wow, that's interesting, to say the least, of how close this company is getting towards San Francisco. Because for a while, as you mentioned, they've been expanding here in the Bay Area. And each time they have generated controversy with local LGBTQ people. Down on the peninsula, the opening of the store in Redwood City several years ago was probably the most controversial. And at the time, Supervisor David Canepa had spoken out about it. So I reached out to him about this one opening in Daly City. And he told me he's not really voicing any opposition to it based on the fact that the company did change their giving policy 2 years ago. And nowadays, he told me when they open, they usually donate a sizable amount of money to a local food bank. And so he said he's not going to make a big deal out of this and hopes that perhaps the owners of this location or just the company as a whole will also, to make amends, maybe target LGBTQ-focused food pantries. We have several here in the city that they could potentially donate to. So
they could possibly sponsor a local radio show or the Bay Area Reporter.
Certainly, if you've been watching television at all in the last year, I certainly have noticed commercials on my cable stations that have Chick-fil-A because they've have so many locations in our area now that they're also advertising. So it's kind of like, for people in San Francisco who may have thought, well, we don't need to deal with this company. They're never going to be near us. You know, well, here they are. And we'll have to see if they do try to secure a location in San Francisco, which potentially they could if they find a location that allows for chain stores like themselves. But they would have to face a gauntlet of city oversight and getting approvals for such a permit.
To note, I just took a quick check of how many Chick-fil-A's are around the Bay Area. There's one on Walnut Creek, Redwood City, Novato, that's in Marin County, San Jose, Fremont, Sunnyvale, and actually there's one in Pittsburgh that's supposed to be opening November 18th also.
Yeah, they're expanding rapidly here in the Bay Area. You know, there are several malls that are desperate for tenants here in San Francisco, and that's where, you know, potentially a chain store could open. We've seen other national chain stores do that recently here in the city, such as Shake Shack. You know, they opened in a mall. A lot of people will, you know, decide on where they want to spend their money at these fast food chains based on what policies they're implementing or stances that maybe they're taking. I mean, I certainly have kind of changed my mind of late of eating at an In-N-Out Burger based on how they don't seem to be following the vaccination requirements for people eating in their stores. Certainly here in the Bay Area, that's been a big issue over the last several weeks. You know, I've certainly seen people on my social media feed saying that, you know, well, I'm not going to go and support them. And other people have said, you know, our mayor even suggested a locally owned burger chain you could spend your money at. And I think the same is true of Chick-fil-A. If you want to send a message, well, then go and find maybe a locally owned queer restaurant instead of going to get your chicken sandwich fix at that chain, right? We're lucky in the Bay Area. We have plenty of options. But I think certainly driving down 280 will never be the same for me when I have to see that signage of a company that I have long refused to eat at as a gay man.
I
got something I want to show you.
I should note, if you're pondering where to eat, according to a recent Business Insider article, McDonald's and Wendy's are among other fast food chains that donate to politicians who oppose the Equality Act. That is, politicians against full LGBTQ rights. Let's move on to this crazy political situation we've got right now. The date was just announced recently for the election for Assembly District 17. So that's the special election to fill the seat left open when David Chu became San Francisco City Attorney on November 1st. And as I understand it, the prominent candidates include current San Francisco Supervisor Matt Haney, who's a big LGBTQ ally, former San Francisco Supervisor David Campos, who's a gay and has been endorsed by the Harvey Milk LGBTQ Democratic Club. He's now the chief of staff for the San Francisco District Attorney, Chesa Boudin, who's a recall target. Gay State Senator Scott Wiener, formerly a supervisor, has come out against the recall of Boudin, and he supports recalling three San Francisco Unified School District board members. So we got a kind of a tangled web here. can you detangle it, demystify that a little bit? What's going on? What's your sense of this?
The open seat election, as everyone kind of expected, is going to be combined with the same ballot as that SF school board recall. And so Governor Gavin Newsom declared that the election itself for the assembly seat would be on April 19th, with the primary to be held on that February 15th ballot, the same ballot as the recall of the three school board members. Who the top target probably in that is Allison Collins, who was removed as vice president of the board and then filed an $85 million lawsuit against the school district and her fellow board members that a judge tossed out. But it's still, you know, costing the school district, which has to cut over $100 million from its budget a big chunk of money to have to fight that lawsuit, even though it really didn't go anywhere.
And that's part of what's behind the recall.
Right, right.
Because some people are ticked off. Why are you wasting so much of our money, money that should be spent on education? And SF Unified has had so much trouble getting things done over the past year and a half with the COVID shutdown, figuring out how to reopen safely for in-person classes, with the teachers union reluctant to do so and demanding safety measures. There was also controversy about renaming schools.
Mm-hmm.
The Allison Collins flap erupted amidst discussions about making Lowell High School, regarded by many as San Francisco's top public high school, more inclusive, less competitive to get into. And it was during those discussions that past tweets Collins had sent surfaced, tweets that were seen by many as anti-Asian, right?
Yes. It's going to be a busy post Valentine's Day Tuesday here in the city of San Francisco with these two elections. And then also because we had an opening for the assessor recorder position here, that's an elected position in San Francisco. The person the mayor appointed to that, Joaquin Torres, he also has to stand for election on that February ballot as well. I haven't seen reporting yet on where he stands on the recall, but all four of the assembly candidates are certainly being asked, you know, do you support all three being recalled or just one? And for voters, you're going to really have to kind of keep track because right now they're all of a different of opinion on the issue.
There's four candidates at this point. Is it too late for anyone else to file?
I think the field's pretty set and that the top two candidates that people are focusing on are David Campos and Supervisor Matt Haney, just because they have a longer track record of being in elected office and probably a better name recognition than Thea Selby, even though she's on the community college board right now. It's kind of not as high profile as being, you know, a city supervisor like Matt currently is, and that what David previously served as.
Now, Matt Haney is a straight guy, but he's been very supportive of the queer community. I think he's the one who is behind the landmarking of the San Francisco Eagle Bar as a landmark, for example. I mean, that's probably not the most substantial, important thing he's done, to say the least. But is there a split among LGBTQ folks, folks who are in the political world on whom to support? Or is Campos clearly getting most of the support from the LGBTQ community?
Well, I think officially, probably Campos will have a lot of support from LGBTQ groups. The Harvey Milk Club already came out in support of him. The city's other main LGBTQ Democratic Club, the Alice B. Toklas, their political action committee is set to vote Friday night on who to recommend. And as I understand it, the membership is going to be voting on Monday of who to back in the race. We'll see if somebody can reach the threshold, because you usually need to get, I believe, 50 or 60% of the vote in order to secure the endorsement. The other thing that's playing out in this race is the fact that, you know, David Campos had initially run for the supervisor seat back against David Chu. And up until David Chu had been elected, it had always been held by an LGBTQ person. And right now, San Francisco does not have an LGBTQ representative in the lower chamber of the state house. So I think there's a lot of desire within the local LGBTQ community to see, you know, representation. But at the same time, as you mentioned, certainly Matt Haney would still be a champion of the community if he were to win the seat. So it may come down to if there's a difference of opinion on an issue you're really passionate about between Matt and David. Certainly a lot of people had hoped that Matt would not get in the race from the LGBTQ community and were disappointed to see him decide to do this, because there had already been discussion of seeing him wait to run for mayor.
Mm.
So it's you know, but it's San Francisco, and we often see this happen where, because of term limits, you know, we see people who have really good track records pitted against each other because open seats don't happen every year, or there's limited amount of movement if you're a politician. What sure. You can run for once you're termed out of your current office.
Is Matt Haney in his last term right now? Is he facing an end of his term soon?
He can run, actually, if he doesn't win the assembly seat, he can run for re-election as a supervisor in November.
You're hearing Out in the Bay. I'm Eric Jansen speaking with Matthew Bajeko, politics columnist and assistant editor of the Bay Area Reporter, LGBTQ newspaper and online news outlet. We're talking politics. We'd love to hear your comments on this show and on past shows. Send them to outinthebay@yahoo.com. You can hear past shows, lots of them, on our website, outinthebay.org. That's outinthebay.org. Matthew, let's move on now to talk about new state laws signed by Governor Newsom in the last 2 months that take effect January 1st. Which ones are of special interest to LGBTQ Californians?
So one of the most important ones probably is one that David Chu, actually, it was one of his last bills to get signed. And that requires the public universities and colleges throughout California to not dead name their trans and non-binary students on their diplomas and academic records. As we've seen over the last 2 years, you know, in states all over the country, the legislators and the governors have been rolling back rights for transgender individuals, and particularly youth, and when it comes to what sports they can play or access to services at school. So I think this, you know, sends a message once again that California is standing up for the rights of its transgender citizens and, you know, setting an example of what could happen in other states, you know, down the line to pass a bill similar to this one. Because if you're a student who's worked, you know, very hard to get a college degree, and we all know how much of a cost that is, not just personally, but financially, and then to be given a diploma that isn't the correct name or gender on it, and you have to hang that up in your office, you know, it's really can be upsetting for those students, particularly, you know, the ones that I've interviewed about this issue in recent years, that they don't want to have to show that. And then also, you know, one of the reasons why Assemblyman Chu pushed this through is that by having the wrong name and gender on your academic records, you're technically being outed to potential employers, landlords who ask for these documents for, you know, to check your qualifications for a job or maybe references and whatnot, and it's not matching up with the name that you've associated them with, then they're going to know that you're maybe non-binary or transgender.
And even so, I mean, even if there's not blatant discrimination, there's just the confusion factor of like, well, your records don't match, so I'm going to go with somebody who's, you know, clearly obvious.
Yeah. The UC system had already moved to address this and were requiring their campuses to start instituting this policy in a couple years. So now this is going to expedite that happening at both the UC and the Cal State campuses. Our City College here in San Francisco, they had already adopted this policy to address the needs of their students who, you know, maybe enroll under their birth name and then have, you know, transition while they're at that campus so that they can update their documents and get a diploma with the right name on it.
There's a similar measure about non-binary death certificates. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so it's the same issue. In death, you want to be recognized for the life you lived, but up until now, you couldn't mark your gender as non-binary. You would be forced to pick, or your loved ones would be forced to pick either male or female. And, you know, that's disrespectful of the deceased. So that was another bill that passed this year to address that. And then there was another bill, kind of a similar vein with marriage licenses and adoption paperwork, where, you know, same-sex households were having issues trying to get the proper names of their kids or themselves on their kids' birth certificates. It was held up for a privacy issue, and they addressed that this year. So you're not being outed as a gay family if you don't want to be, because it requires some court documentation that now you can request isn't available to be seen by the public.
Oh, right. So it used to be a public record, and now it's at the person's option whether to keep that private, sealed.
And on the same vein with respecting people's genders, several bills were passed this year to just clean up the usage of male pronouns throughout various state codes when it refers to certain elected positions. So back in the day, when they wrote, you know, these codes, they would just use male pronouns
as the default.
Yeah. And now we have, you know, obviously women, and, you know, potentially we can see some transgender and non-binary people down in future elections be elected to these posts. And so you want to have the ability to use language that's reflective of that. And, you know, one of the people that endorsed and helped push through these bills is our lieutenant governor, who's a woman, but in the codes, they just refer to that person as being a man. And so she obviously had an interest in seeing this changed as well.
There's also one I wanted to ask you about financial advisors being required now to do to have LGBTQ competency training, so that when they're advising people, they can, you know, anybody you go to is going to have to have that expertise along with everything else. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
So I think this one was written specifically with LGBTQ seniors in mind, who unfortunately in the current 55 and plus age group right now, they lived through a time where being gay was not as easy as it is for people who are, you know, just now coming up in their 20s and 30s. So they often have been cut off ties from their family because of being, you know, LGBTQ. Certainly for a lot of older gay men who survived the AIDS epidemic, they lost their partners, their best friends. And so now they are aging alone and they don't have anyone to get advice from. And so when they need to, you know, put their financial house in order, so to speak, if it's, you know, regarding their retirement needs or a will or, you know, different things that may come up, you want to make sure that your fiduciary is not going to be discriminatory towards you or uncomfortable dealing with an LGBTQ person. And they have some unique needs there because they are living on their own. And so you want that person to kind of just know what the issues LGBTQ seniors could be facing when you go and talk with them. So that's kind of where that bill comes from.
There's also a new law protecting the privacy of healthcare information and another regarding insurance for HIV positive people. Please tell us about those two.
Yeah, so the HIV bill was focused on insurance, so making sure that you're not cut off because of your HIV status when it comes to life insurance and some other policies that you may need, because once again, HIV is no longer a death sentence. And so people who were maybe thinking in their 30s that they weren't going to live long enough to need life insurance, right? Now were facing some issues where they weren't getting coverage because of their HIV status. So this makes sure you don't run into those problems. And the other bill that you brought up was another bill that actually Assemblyman Chu push through, and it makes sure that people who are on their parents' policies or on another person's policy and wants to go and get, say, like a gender transition services through their healthcare provider, that's not inadvertently disclosed to the holder of your policy via the mail, because obviously the health insurance company would send something out in the mail with either the bill or, you know, the itemized rundown of what it's going to cost you or any kind of communication like that. So this way you can request that type of mailing doesn't go out to your parents, say if you're a trans youth and you're not out to them, right? Or there's other instances where it could come up.
Sure. Do you know if that's mandatory, like required, or is that an opt-in thing, or is it like the healthcare companies have to just assume that this information should not be forwarded to it goes to the patient, not to the
right
policy holder?
So they're going to be required to ask people about this. So it's probably going to be on an intake form. You know, I mean, they'll figure out a way that to make sure that they're not violating the law. But I would suspect, I believe it goes into effect January 1st. And so starting next year, you'll probably get a notification from your health insurance company asking you, you know, is it okay to send a, you know, mail to the holder of this policy? And this has become more of an issue because of actually, you know, the expansion of healthcare over the years through Obamacare, and where they raised the age limit for children to remain on their parents' policies. So you've got people up into their early 20s who potentially are still, you know, covered by their parents, but maybe, you know, so they could be living on their own, but still have insurance through their mom and dad, but maybe they haven't told them that they are transitioning yet.
Or even that they're gay.
Right, exactly. So, or, you know, if maybe you're not disclosing that you're HIV positive and a letter comes in about, you know, an increase in a drug cost or a new HIV medicine potentially that you could apply for, maybe it works for you, because, you know, there's advances in HIV meds all the time. So this way, your health status is protected and is disclosed to who you want it to be disclosed to, and not some, you know, anonymous health insurance employee just automatically sending out a letter and not really even thinking about it.
Right. I'm shocked that wasn't already the law. I'm actually insured through Aetna right now through my partner's policy, and he's getting stuff about my healthcare. Like, what the hell? I mean, I don't have any secrets to hide from him, but what if I did?
Right. Yeah, the same thing happens with me and my husband, because my husband's on my healthcare plan. And so I'll routinely get something in the mail after he's gone to see his doctor or even our dentist. You know, I mean, we're on the same plan, but it all comes under my name, even though it's his healthcare, right?
Anything else you want to mention before we wrap up here?
I think we've covered enough today, don't you think?
Yeah, we've covered a lot. That's Matthew Bajeko, political columnist and assistant editor of the Bay Area Reporter online and print news service covering San Francisco and Northern California. We spoke last Friday, November 12th. His articles on Chick-fil-A and the state assembly race were published this week. You can find them online at ebar.com. That's ebar.com. Or go to outinthebay.org, where we'll include links to Matthew's articles in the post about this week's show. That's outinthebay.org, where you can hear this show and past shows and share them with friends, please. And sign up for our email newsletter to be notified of new episodes. You can also subscribe there to Out in the Bay podcasts. That's outinthebay.org. Please also consider making a donation there, won't you, to help us keep bringing queer air to your ears. We are a totally nonprofit, independent production. That means we receive no funds from the radio stations that air Out in the Bay weekly, nor from NPR, nor from podcast platforms. We rely on listener support. Big thanks to generous donors Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, and Cornelia Enders of San Francisco, and Bud Dillon of San Francisco. We'll thank you on the air only if you'd like us to. That's outinthebay.org. And if you have a business that you'd like to be thanked or recognized each week on the air, on our site, and on our podcasts, in exchange for your support, please do contact us, outinthebay@yahoo.com. That's outinthebay@yahoo.com. Our theme music was written and performed by Holly Mead. We thank KALW 91.7 FM and San Francisco Public Press and its radio station KSFP 102.5 FM, and WORT 89.9 FM in Madison, Wisconsin, which now airs Out in the Bay monthly. Big thanks also to this week's audio editor, Christopher Beal. Want to join our team? Email us, outinthebay@yahoo.com. That's outinthebay@yahoo.com. I'm Eric Jansen. Thank you for listening, and thanks for joining us out in the Bay.